Henry, why do the smokestacks have those things like balconies around them?
Worried about the climate? Well, not much we can do about it. Or is there?
Campaigners say they'll press ahead with a day of mass action tomorrow against plans for a new coal-fired power station at King's North.
Yeah, that's right. It might be good first just to make sure everyone knows about the three different actions that people from the camp have been involved in this morning.
When Great Britain discovered oil and gas in the North Sea during the 1990s, they set an example to the world by closing down most of their coal industry. The governments of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown have led the world in pronouncements about clean energy and saving the world from extreme climate change. So why is the same government doing everything it can to increase greenhouse gases? The British government has recently announced a return to coal-fired power. They want to build the first big new coal plants at an existing site called King's North. Actually, it's at the southeast tip of England, not that far from London. At the same time, along with their European counterparts, the government has announced huge new additions of allegedly green biofuels. As we'll hear, these actually cost the planet dearly, creating more greenhouse gases and starvation. As air travel pollutes the skies, London is adding yet more runways and air terminals for endless holiday travel. The contradictions, the madness of wrecking the climate while talking green, can drive us into zombie depression. Or it can drive ordinary people into action.
So you two went on different blocks, but you're actually here at the camp together.
We are. We actually got married on the 5th of
July,
and we decided do something different for our honeymoon. What could be different than come to climate camp and do something really positive?
From August 3rd to 11th, King's North was the scene of a well-organized climate camp and the hub for multiple climate demonstrations around the country. Video of the scene shows thousands of very ordinary-looking people, older couples, balding men, young families with strollers, college students. The protests were the usual non-violent fare, marches with a dragon, workshops on alternative energy, floating down a river on homemade rafts, hanging banners, making organic food. The reaction was typical post-9/11 paranoia from the same government allegedly supporting all these aims. Thousands of police with dogs, SWAT teams, powerboats, helicopters, and horses descended on the crowd. Early into the camp, the police swept in, for no particular reason I might add, to search everyone. They confiscated children's crayons because they could be used to make signs. They trumpeted to the media the discovery of a set of cooking knives. Obviously proof of violent intent, or maybe proof that thousands of people needed to be fed. The media grabbed the violence angle and tried very hard to isolate these social germs, these citizens who stood up to say that coal is killing the planet. Obviously, these are dangerous people.
Hello there, good afternoon. Knives, makeshift weapons and bolt cutters, just some of the items Kent police say they've found
Kent
near the so-called Camp for Climate Change.
Kent police say they've drafted in 700 officers and have a £1 million budget with which they're determined to stop activists closing down King's North Power Station.
Stand off, police and protesters watch and wait, getting ready for a massive march against a replacement
police
power station.
Police in riot gear have used batons and pepper spray on campaigners who are gathering outside King's North
Six
Power Station.
Six arrested as riot police clash with protesters at the King's North climate camp. One MP condemns police tactics as aggressive.
Are you a dangerous person? Can you break away from the television, join your neighbors and do something for the planet? Let's find out what our British cousins do when the government is nuts and their children's future is at stake. We don't need the mainstream news hacks to find out what happened. New media is taking over. A group of alternative radio producers banded together and set up a series of really good live broadcasts from the camp. You'll hear from that original material at the scene. Alternative filmmakers were all over this climate camp as well. We'll focus on one called Vision On TV. Get ready for rowdy women, barking dogs, scantily clad smart young women, George Monbiot, anti-Monbiot, anarchy and agri-fuels. It's the Radio EcoShock Climate Camp Hour. I'm Alex Smith.
I find this movement the most exciting thing that I've ever been involved in. I've been involved in a lot of direct action movements in the past, and they've all been thrilling in their different ways. But the ones I've been involved in the past have had difficulties of various kinds. There's been a lot of identity politics. There's been a lot of people having a go at the police in lieu of their fathers. There's been all sorts of mixtures of political motives involved. But what I find here, and what I've found in the recent climate change actions that I've been involved in, is people who have come here to stop climate change. And they know exactly what they're doing, and they know how they're going to go about it and do that. And it's a whole new generation of activists mingling with us old crocs who've got some experience but don't have their new energy which they're bringing in. And that's a great combination. It's very exciting to see it happen. Well, this is another thing which has been really inspiring to me. I mean, what we've seen in South Wales, for instance, where we've been taking on the biggest open cast coal mine in Britain, one of the biggest in Europe, this monster at Force of Ran, just on the outskirts of Merthyr Tydfil. What we've been doing there is working hand in glove with the local people. They asked us to come and try to stop this mine. They had thrown everything they could at it, and they'd failed to stop it. And so, in desperation, they said, we need you guys to come and do some direct action here, to come and put it right back at the forefront of people's minds. And we have established a fantastic relationship with them. They are people who have been dragged into action. They're not people who are particularly political, but their whole quality of life and their whole everything they valued in their lives has been threatened by this monster mine, which has been landed right on their doorsteps. I mean, the nearest homes are 36 metres from where the edge of the pit is going to be. And it's only been made possible because the planning guidance for coal in Wales was delayed for long enough to allow planning permission for this monster to go through without a proper buffer zone around it. And we've found there a whole new source of inspiration. People whose lives were pulled into this against their will, but who have become extremely inspiring campaigners, starting from a very different perspective to ours. And so we've been building wholly new coalitions there.
That's British author, columnist and campaigner George Monbiot speaking to Vision On TV. On August 5th, he wrote a very strong article in the Guardian newspaper explaining why he personally is opposed to the mad return to coal burning. Yet anarchists from the climate camp fought against Monbiot. They called him a green Stalin. Why? Because George finds there isn't time for a revolution first due to climate change and the looming deadline of carbon. Capitalist or whatever powers that can act must act now, he says. This is a dialogue running into various anti-capitalists and libertarians right here in North America, so let's listen in for a minute to Thursday's Climate Camp Radio.
To their knowledge, it could just be in support of what is fundamentally a, you know, sort of green Stalinist platform, like Monbiot, calling for state-centered solutions, which will result in, you know, only more and more regulation and control over people's day-to-day lives. And that's fundamentally antithetical to anarchism and bottom-up self-organization. So we felt that would be good to actually have this debate as a whole, as a camp, because the future of the camp, and to some extent the future of the planet, is in the balance, that there are ultimately two options. That capitalism, by its own internal dynamics, is clearly failing, and we either have some sort of eco-totalitarian state, you know, controlled, you know, by people who may, at the current point, be our friends, you know, and or we're going to have some sort of push towards a more egalitarian anarchist society where actually our forms of life and our patterns of production and consumption and work change. And we believe this is such an important debate that it would be useful to have it at the entire camp, if at all possible, and to make sure that when we do direct action, people are actually putting their you know, bodies on the line, that they can, to some extent, you know, green Stalinist program like Mambio's. I'm going to put my body on the line for an anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian revolution.
As a result, even the mass action is now likely to be interpreted as a gesture of support for tightened social control and austerity measures visited upon the population.
I would respond to that by saying that you shouldn't try and narrow it down to merely the anarchist tradition. Anarchists are very few and far between, mostly younger, tending not to vote, so not having much power in the sense of traditional political power. And I think no matter what happens, I don't think you're going to overthrow the world's power before you stop climate change. It's going to take a long, long while. You've got to work with the powers that be already, which are the people that kind of are elected into governments, which is socialists and greens. And you've got to put the pressure on them. There's a place for anarchy in direct action, in showing the way and illustrating what can be done, which is exactly what Climate Camp does, what it's very good at. But to just throw away all forms of sort of state authority, I think is very naive. I mean, I think, you know, if you talk about freedom, all right, let's be a bit brutal in the argument here, but you don't allow paedophiles the freedom to murder children, do you? So why allow tourists the freedom to fly on holiday, which is going to lead to the death of millions, if not billions, of children in the future? You have to have some sort of state control, and I think you have to have some sort of rationing of flying. And
could I just do a quick response? I think there's this. I think what is fundamentally a myth that the state is in any way capable of dealing with the scope of this crisis. So if you look at any sort of state-centered solutions so far, they have been complete and utter miserable failures. They've only created further markets from climate change. They've made it worse than the worst possible scientific predictions. And what do we believe? I think the thesis is that somehow if there's enough popular sort of begging of the state, you know, through some sort of mass electoral movement, you'll have a maybe Green Party or maybe the Swappies in power, and they'll begin sort of putting these measures of austerity for the common good into effect. I think that's incredibly unlikely. I think, you know, while anarchists are few and far between, Greens and socialists are incredibly few and far between and are in electoral politics ludicrously weak. What you're seeing, almost without fail, as in most of the world, is the return of nationalist parties, of parties which are fundamentally, particularly in places which are under some form of threat, proto-fascist at their core. I think we have to be very careful, because I think that what's more likely to happen with any sort of resort to a state-based solution is that people will use the excuse that, oh, we have to do this, this is such a big crisis, to sort of A, not do anything substantial to solve the crisis, and then B, use the excuse of the crisis to basically clamp down on popular dissent through these measures that are justified via green austerity. So what you're more likely to see is not a sort of benevolent, swappy dictatorship for the love of the planet, a Green Party control with maybe a slow generational change to democratic politics. What you think you're more likely to see in the next 5 years is some sort of green Stalinist state, which will fundamentally use climate change as a measure to control the people. And the climate change crisis will likely get worse. I don't think electoral politics can solve it. Well, the only thing which can obviously solve it is a change in a form of life. And that is what the anarchists and direct Democrats and the people at this camp are demonstrating. And that is not what the Greens or socialists are demonstrating.
Both of our solutions look pretty remote. But I think ours of trying to sort of work through the electoral system is more likely to work than the anarchist system of completely overthrowing all the powers that be.
Well, that conversation never ends, and good luck to you solving it. I don't have the answers. Meanwhile, we have a small blue planet to save. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and we're looking at clips and the events from the UK climate camp in early August 2008.
Just going to climb into the eco-shitter and pop the recorder down.
they had people with fake sort of spoof information t-shirts, which looked like they were official airport t-shirts. But instead of saying, can I help you, they said, can I hinder you? And when people came and asked them for information, they told them to take the train into the Royal Bank of Scotland in central London. And you know, people locking themselves to chain themselves together in the front and covering themselves in oil and pretending to be dead thanks to RBS's evil funding of E.ON and various other awful fossil fuel projects.
Nice.
So, and all of those, as far as we know, I mean, I don't know the details for media coverage of the Gatwick one, but at the World Bank of Scotland action from all the sort of mainstream channels, and yeah, and various other journalists and photographers have been really interested. We've had lots of calls. We did, they're all press released.
Hello, I'm 150,000 people who die every year from climate change. Students from around the country are protesting RBS as they have over £10 billion invested in fossil fuel extraction projects. They are the lead contributor in the financial world to climate change. They have more embedded emissions than the whole of Scotland. So blocking the front entrance, 13 other students helped took part in a die-in, and so we managed to blockade the front entrance for 15 minutes.
And this radio program is brought to you by many people who have come together for this project, and those include Dissident Island, Rise Up Radio, Flash Radio, PlentyFact.net, Bristol Wireless, and Indie Media UK.
An action at the big agrofuels refinery at Thurrock, where people lock themselves together with lock-on tubes and lay down in front of the gates to block the lorries from coming in. Mm. Pretty amazing.
Again, here is Vision On TV.
Yes, I'm Andrew Boswell. I'm from Biofuel Watch, and we campaign against unsustainable biofuels and agrofuels.
So why is this such a big issue? Surely agrofuels are the solution to all our problems.
Well, no, unfortunately they're certainly not, and they're really an emerging crime against humanity, actually, in several dimensions. The first one is they actually accelerate climate change. Second one is that they're playing a large part in the global food crisis we've seen, you know, happening for several years now, but really built up this year with rising food prices. And they're having huge social impacts in the global south, with people being moved off their land to grow agrofuel plantations.
So why is this a climate change issue?
Well, the issue with agrofuels is that there's actually a huge amount of emissions generated in producing them, and it's from a number of sources. The really big hit, and this is science which has come out this year, is that when you create an agrofuel plantation, you have to displace land which is used for something else. Now, very often at the moment, that's rainforest or peatland. And scientific research this year has shown that that will cause up to a carbon debt of up to 800 years. And that what that actually means is that 800 times as much CO2 is produced and released into the atmosphere than could be recovered from using the agrofuel as a substitute for diesel or whatever. Even on sort of a land like preservation land in the US, if they start putting corn into that sort of land, it's not rainforest, but even that has a 50-year hit. So this actually is just a crime, climate crime against humanity in itself. It's causing massive greenhouse gas emissions.
And so, after months of planning, all the while watched by Britain's endless police state, where they have more cameras than anywhere else in the world, the camp rises up beside the King's North Power Station. It is time for participants to learn and to learn to know the power of civil action. We'll get to the big march, the flotilla, the barking dogs, but first, let's listen into the workshops and the issues. We'll start with some info on the real solutions, alternative energy. Then we'll hear how women are most hurt by climate change and most active against it. This is from Climate Radio, live at the camp, from an alternative energy workshop.
So next we're going to go into an interview that we did with David from CAT, the Center for Alternative Technology. Chickpea
and Patrick
from Climate Camp Radio, and we are sitting here with David from CAT, which is the Center for Alternative Technology. What is CAT and what does it do? Maybe give us a bit of background.
CAT is a sustainability organization. It was set up 35 years ago to find practical solutions to the issues of sustainable living. So CAT looks at energy, at building materials, at recycling, at composting, at all these types of things. And 30-odd years of trying to play with these technologies, of practicing with them, and teaching others from basically the things that we've got right and the things we've got wrong.
So maybe you can describe some of the systems that you have in place and have experimented with.
We've had lots of different things. We provide all our own electricity and our own heat. We have our own water treatment and sanitation systems. As the centre's got bigger and bigger, as we've done more training and more education and we write books and things like that, we've had to expand all those systems. So we now have electricity from wind, from water, from photovoltaics, and we're just building a combined heat and power plant that runs on wood, and that will also provide all the heat for site. And that's quite innovative. There are very few of them in this country, so we're experimenting with it. And then we're going to try and use that for greenhouses and for sequestration of carbon, perhaps. So basically, sort of trying to see how practically you can use these things, trying to put them in place and live with them to see what it really does and how it really works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on the practicality scale, how easy or difficult is it for just the average individual to incorporate some of the things that you have at CAT?
It depends on what it is you're trying to do. The first of all of these things is to try and use less energy in the first place, or use less water, less materials, because it makes everything a lot easier, a lot cheaper, a lot simpler. Then from that, it depends on what it is that you use most of, what you spend your money on, what's the most polluting activities you do. Everybody has a different reason for trying to do this. They want to save more money, or they want to produce less carbon, or everybody has a different reason. So you would try and choose a technology that reduces your biggest expenditure. And it depends on where you live. Some things are more practical if you live in the countryside in a big house with loads of land, there are lots of things that are very easy. If you live in a block of flats, it's a lot harder. Mm-hmm. So there's no one solution. We use most of our energy in terms of heat. So things that keep your house warm and systems for replacing the heating system with something more sustainable, that's always a good bet. Solar thermal systems, things like that. Mm-hmm. Then we move on to the electricity generation, because that's usually a little more expensive.
Do you think it's possible to kind of live sustainably in an urban setting where you don't have as much land where you can do things and it's not possible to generate all your own electricity?
It's possible, but you have to be part of a bigger network. There's a lot of talk of wanting to be very separate, very, very off-grid, to separate yourself off from the rest of society. It doesn't work like that. If we're going to do these things, we have to do them all together. You can buy your electricity from a 100% green supplier if you live in a flat, and that's then all come from renewables if you buy it from a good supplier. So you can do that without having to have the expense of putting up photovoltaics or wind turbines, because that's not really practical in your situation. So you can still live a very, very green, very sustainable lifestyle even if you live in a city. But we have to have the countrywide infrastructure to make that possible.
I'm personally concerned with the raw materials that are necessary to create some sustainable energy producing mechanisms. Maybe you have some sort of insight on that and whether it's actually possible to move away from these materials that will become more rare in the future.
All of the things that we build have to require some energy, some materials. So we tend to look at the life cycle cost of this, how much energy it produces compared to how much it takes to build, and how long it takes to pay those things off. So, and it's a good decision as whether that technology is right for where you live. Mm-hmm. A wind turbine in a windy place will pay off its energy costs, embodied energy, very, very quickly. If you bolt it onto your house in the middle of a housing estate, it may never pay for itself. That's a very good indicator of whether it's worthwhile, and you have to pick the right technology for the right location because of that, as well as the monetary cost. I suppose the people do try and look at making these things more sustainable because of all the industries. People who are making systems for renewable technologies are quite aware of the sustainability, the sustainable nature of their products. Mm-hmm. It would be a lie to say that there isn't any impact with them at all. And I suppose it's something we just have to keep our eye on to demand the same level as we do from everything else we buy.
So do you think that renewable energy will ever be able to become mass consumable, something that will be able to be afforded by kind of everybody rather than just kind of people who are willing to pay a premium?
Yes, but it's going to take a lot of doing. It's something that has to come down from a government level. It has to be something that we lobby for, that we push for, to force the energy companies to supply more of our energy from sustainable resources, because there are people who can't afford to buy these systems for their individual houses. And some people, as we've said, don't live in places where it's suitable. Some people just can't afford it. So we as a country have to provide those things on a national basis so that it's renewable energy available for all. If you plug something into the wall, that you know it's coming from renewable sources. But we can only do that by getting our politicians, by lobbying them, by forcing them, by whatever means, to accept higher levels of renewables penetration into the grid. And it's perfectly feasible. We can design renewable energy grids for the country which will run on 20%, 50% or 100% renewables. It's, you just have to have that target and work towards it. The problem is if you change from one to the other, then it becomes a big issue. You have to know what it is you're aiming for, and we have to stick to those targets.
So do you think that renewable energy has the potential to fill the kind of real or perceived energy gap that seems to be looming?
Definitely. Britain has one of the highest renewable energy resources in Europe. We have the most amount of wind, of tidal energy. We're basically the Saudi Arabia of renewable resource. The energy gap, as it's perceived, is because of the nature of our consumption of energy. The national grid was set up so that you could have as much power as you wanted whenever you wanted it. That was the aim behind it. So we have a lot of redundancy built in. We have safeguards upon safeguards. We have a system which is designed to be consumed to excess. What we need is a different system, a system where energy is agreed, it's not limitless, that you pay an increased price for having that energy whenever you want it. It doesn't mean that people can't have energy, but if I want to do something right here, right now, I pay more for that. If I'm willing to wait a little bit until it's a little bit windier and the waves are a little stronger, then my energy is cheaper. And that's very easy to do. There are lots of devices out there which a lot of things we do are not time critical in terms of the energy it uses. Your fridge, for example, doesn't have to be on all the time. It comes on for 5 minutes an hour. If it chooses to do that now, then electricity could be a certain price. If it waits 10 minutes, electricity might be a little cheaper. And to put these devices on fridges costs about £5 a fridge. Mm-hmm. It's not a massive investment, but it's something that needs to be done, again, as a national strategy to make these things possible. It has to be kind of done all at once.
And do you think that renewables have the potential to supply, like, really heavily energy-intensive industries like, you know, smelting or something like that, where you just use abundant amount of energy?
Again, it's possible. All of these processes, as energy becomes more expensive, it's amazing how much they look at how much energy it consumes and ways that can be reduced. One of the key components in the cost of materials at the moment is the energy that goes into processing it. And it's a simple financial necessity that those processes are now revisited, far outside of the ideas of climate change and energy security. It's just simple business practice to redesign these systems to be less energy intensive. But the energy that's required for them still has to come from somewhere, and that could just as easily be renewables as it could be fossil fuels or nuclear.
I kind of take issue with the idea that we have to appeal so much to governmental structures in order for the infrastructure to change. I mean,
I agree, and I believe that we should all take responsibility for what we do and where that energy comes from. The fact that these systems are centralised means that you have to approach the central point where that power congregates. You have to work with, to a certain extent, work with what's there. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we can't change it in many ways. There are a lot of different and better ways of doing what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But all these things can't happen overnight. And there is a limit to the practicality of me doing absolutely everything myself. There has to be a certain amount of sharing, a certain amount of working with others to make this possible. You're right, it doesn't have to be at a government level. It can just as easy be at a community level.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We'll be right back in about 30 seconds with more from this energy workshop at the UK Climate Camp and some more about the protests and the police reaction there.
The age of the baby boomer generation is over. They paid their dues, and now they gotta pay for their baby food. They screwed the environment and realized it just in time for retirement. But private pensions ain't so inspiring. Some of them wonder how they're gonna get by when the government doesn't let anyone hire them. Benefits are better for teachers and firemen, but the rest ain't showing no teeth when they're smiling. Cause their kids' damn business plans is freestyling. Chilling on beaches on Tahitian Island, riding jet skis. Most MCs never gave a thought to RSPs. So the pension, tension, everybody's inching closer to the edge of income suspension. There's a monkey wrench in this economic engine. Listen to the denture convention. So the pension, tension, everybody's inching closer to the edge of income suspension. There's a monkey wrench in this economic engine. Listen to the denture convention.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and today we're investigating the UK climate camp that happened in early August. It's a protest against the King's North coal generating plant. Apparently the UK government is going back on all their climate commitments and all their big promises to return to coal as a source of power. They want to build two big coal plants, all powered by the Royal Bank of Scotland. So there's been all kinds of protests about this. We're going to find out more. And a lot of this comes from Climate Camp Radio and On the Site Radio, put together by a bunch of independent radio producers, and also from Vision On TV, which we'll hear some clips from that as well. So let's get back to our activist workshop about alternative energy. And again, the question keeps coming up. How much can the individual do, and how much should the government be allowed to do about climate change?
But the idea that we all just wrap ourselves up in little boxes and do it for ourselves isn't going to work.
Oh yeah, I completely understand that it just does not make sense for the individual to try and be entirely self-sufficient. It's impossible, and it's also counterproductive, I think, on a social level. My issue is with the sort of the green authoritarianism that can sort of happen with regulating energy, and I think the issue is taking away the power of the people that provide the power, in a sense. And
The nice thing about renewable energy is that by its very nature it is decentralized. It's no longer held in a dozen large power stations. It's spread all over the countryside. It becomes part of us. It becomes something that we live with, in and around. So by that very nature you feel more connected to it. You have more of a say in how it happens, about where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
For good and for bad. But we get a lot more contact with it. It's good to be aware of where these things come from, mm-hmm. because you have more awareness, more appreciation of it. Ideally, everybody should be very, very keen on knowing everything about where it all comes from, but in the society we live in, people aren't.
Mm-hmm.
Being here, you're sort of preaching to the converted in that respect.
Yeah.
But we have to, I suppose, work on behalf of those people who aren't that committed, that interested, that bothered by it, and make those decisions for them.
Just in terms of the decentralised nature of renewable power, I mean, we have a lot of Medway residents here who are kind of unhappy about the kind of asthma levels and the social and environmental impacts that King's North and the other kind of polluting, the other kind of sources of pollution around here have. But there's kind of similar problems with decentralized renewable power. I mean, you have, especially with wind power, there's a lot of kind of local opposition to large wind farms being erected. Like we had the island in the Outer Hebrides that was a kind of potentially huge source of wind power. That project has now been turned down on the basis of local opposition.
The difference between something like a coal-fired power station and a wind farm is that the basis for opposition of a wind farm is almost entirely aesthetic. It's the visual impact on our environment. There are other concerns, but if you get down to it, basically, people don't like the way they look. And because you have to have a lot more of them, they physically take up more space and they're more visual, that's what people pick on. People don't like how coal-fired power stations look either. They're not the prettiest of items. But there's only one of them. Well, there's only one of them within 50 miles or so. So it's not such an issue. But you don't have the same health concerns. So what people have found is that in areas where they've had wind farms put up, for example, wind farms is a good example for this country, that there tends to be a big drop in people's enthusiasm for the system just as it's being built. And then when the system's actually in place and people start living with it, they find that it's not as bad as they thought. All these impacts, the visual, the noise, the flicker, these things that people talk about aren't actually really big concerns at all. You just get used to it being there, and you don't have the asthma, the sulfur dioxide, the acid rain, all the other environmental concerns. All you have is a spinning wind turbine.
How come they all have to be white? Could you not like paint them green or like make them blend in a bit?
That's a good question. In theory, you could paint them any colour you like. I believe they paint them white because they're supposed to blend in more easily. But one of the nice things that we do have is a policy of not allowing people to write things all over wind turbines, so you can't use them as big spinning advertising boards. So be thankful they all have to be white. Otherwise, you'll be seeing Tesco's labels all over them.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably a case of watch this space.
I guess I just have one more question about the imperceived effects of the technology of renewables. Invariably, there's going to be something that we don't know about that is going to be problematic, and we're going to have to fix that, and it's a case of always relying on technology.
A lot of the perceptions of problems with renewables come from misinformation, sort of lack of understanding. A lot of the technologies are... they're becoming more and more established. We're getting to know a lot more about the effects that they have on the environment. Wind turbines, for example, we know a lot of the problems that they had when they first built wind turbines. Mm-hmm. Things like bird strikes and things like that. And that was quite easy to fix. We don't put wind turbines where birds migrate and things like that. It took a bit of practice, but we learn very quickly from those mistakes. And with every new technology, there are going to be things that we find, things that we have to address and deal with. But I suppose we try and learn from the mistakes that we've made and as much as is possible predict what's going to be an effect and how you get around it. But a lot of these technologies are passive technologies. They're very benign. They should, in theory, have very little impacts. So I would hope, as much as possible, we're making them as clean and as green as possible. The whole point of them is that you can install these systems and pretty much just leave them there for us and generations to come. So I'd want to build something that was going to still be working in a nice, healthy, sustainable fashion for well into the future.
The cases of things like the Severn Barrier, where there is like an impact on nature and on things like wind turbines and bird strikes on migratory patterns, I mean, do you think there has to be a trade-off made for kind of the future of the planet versus the kind of localized ecosystem? That may be very important, but...
Severn Barrage is a fantastic example of exactly that type of situation. The theoretical potential of a scheme like that could provide huge amounts of our national energy, and that's why it's one that's talked about. But there are massive environmental impacts associated with that. Mm-hmm. So it is always going to be a balance. Everything we do has a footprint, a result from doing that, and you have to weigh up in the long term whether that impact is small enough, whether it's worth making that construction and dealing with the consequences afterwards. There are a lot of other proposals for the River Severn, such as tidal lagoons, or which are smaller systems. You end up with a lot more of them, and they have less of an impact because they don't fully obstruct the river. I think if it's going to go ahead, at the end of the day, it'll be something more like that type of technology, because you still get a lot of the energy out of it, but you don't get the same, quite as much of the environmental impact. Mm-hmm. But we do have to weigh up the bigger picture. I would love that we could do things which had absolutely no impact at all. But it's trying to make a system which still produces the most amount of energy, but has the least impact at all. I suppose it's there's no easy way around it.
Well, on that note, we'll sign off. Thank you very much for coming in to speak with us, and good luck with CAT.
Thank you very much.
That was David from CAT, which is the Centre for Alternative Technology in the UK, being interviewed by Chickpea and Patrick at Climate Camp Radio last August. Here is a report from the privately owned Channel 4 News.
But it's not just climate campers who are arguing against him.
This is not just a fringe issue. 227 MPs signed an early day motion against King's North. The Royal Society and the ex-government chief scientist, Sir David King, both against the current proposal to King's North, as are almost every environment group in the country, like Friends of the Earth, and the major development groups, like Christian Aid. So this is really broad opposition to a really bad proposal, and Malcolm Wicks needs to say no to it and no to E.ON.
Not everyone is against coal, at least not this seasoned veteran of summer protests against government energy policy.
We should be taking all the power stations, all the coal mines back into public ownership, reopening pits, opening new pits, and having a sensible, integrated energy policy based on clean coal technology and alternative sources such as wind, wave, tide, geothermal and solar.
But with clean coal years away at best, to many, a yes to King's North will jeopardise any future climate change policy.
Well, we did ask to speak to someone from E.ON, the company that runs the farm, but we're told no one was available. We're joined now by David Porter, the chief executive of the Association of Electricity Producers, the umbrella group. And from King's North, we're joined by Caroline Lucas, the Green Party MEP for the area, who's about to address the campaigners. Caroline Lucas, are you encouraging them to break the law and try and close down King's North?
I'm welcoming them here. I think it's absolutely fantastic that they've come here. They've come from all different parts of the country because they understand, as the government doesn't seem to, that if King's North goes ahead, then basically we are literally staring climate change in the face. The chances of actually getting off the collision course with climate change will be almost impossible, because it's not just this coal-fired power station.
Sure, we'll get to that in a second.
If this one goes ahead, there'll be seven more.
Can you just be clear on the direct action? Do you support it?
I support direct action if it's done peacefully. I believe there are times in life, as there were with the suffragettes, for example, where when it's clear that the democratic channels have failed, then it is perfectly legitimate to take peaceful direct action. I wish it hadn't come to this. I wish that the government would listen to common sense, to world scientists, to a huge number of people who are saying basically that we don't need this coal-fired power station. If we do it, we give a signal to the rest of the world, David, that the way to deal with climate change is through coal.
David Porter. Are you going to be able to defend the plant?
I'm sure that the company will make every effort, and huge numbers of police have been drafted in to protect the plant and its employees. And I read Caroline's blog today. It was a little bit disingenuous. It talked about these people having come to King's North and setting up a camp where they would teach people to bake vegan cakes and learn about renewable energy. In fact, the focus of this camp is a break-in on the power station, possibly for Saturday, and they have declared that they want to close it down. Normal everyday protest is fine, and nobody would object to that, but what they're actually proposing is irresponsible and possibly even dangerous.
Caroline Lucas.
Well, it's very fine for David Porter to talk about irresponsibility. The most irresponsible thing you could be doing right now is giving the go-ahead to another coal-fired power station in a country where we don't need it, where we're going to basically then commit ourselves to a high-carbon infrastructure. We are going to then really have a very, very difficult time to meet our emission reduction targets. We're going to be staring climate change in the face. That is the irresponsibility. People here are indeed coming to learn about alternative energy. They are coming here for a variety of reasons.
People in Britain have plenty of reason to be upset about the government's about-turn on more coal, roads and air traffic. Professor Bob Watson, the chief scientific advisor to the Department of the Environment, warned Britons just this week to prepare for a rise of 4 degrees Celsius, that's 7 degrees Fahrenheit, by the year 2100. at 4 degrees, wild floods and rising seas displace up to a billion people, melting the poles, and a mass extinction event would be expected. British scientists, including Sir James Lovelock and the Royal Academy, have been clear about the developing crisis in our climate. And the public has experienced unnatural flooding there from extreme rainfall events. A new paper in the journal Science explains why these amplified precipitation extremes may become the norm as the world heats up. The heavy rains will destroy crops in a time of increasing hunger and spread infectious diseases, mainly through insects. Well, we've seen some of those crazy floods in the U.S. Midwest as well. Get ready where you live. The newspaper and televisions in Europe are much more forthright about the impacts of climate change. They know it's coming. People there are past a tipping point, demanding change any way they can. As in America and Canada, their governments are not just failing them, but acting against the interests of the planet's future. It's big business as usual, wherever you look. When you speak up, here's what you can expect from the authorities and the mainstream media.
The police have entered through a back gate here. As you can see, they're trying to hold their ground in the middle of a field. The protesters are trying to remove them peacefully from the ground that they're camping on.
To many people observing and to people camping on the site, it wasn't clear why the police had taken the action they had.
BBC Television, can I ask you a quick question? Why you came onto the field at all?
Well, you can ask me. Whether or not I'm going to answer you is a different question.
Well, I'm asking you, why did you come onto the field?
We've come on set for the safety of the campers here.
And what was concerning you about their safety?
We had intelligence received that said we needed to come onto the site. So.
And currently now it seems a bit of a standoff. What's going to happen next?
There's no standoff. We're just waiting to confirm what our next actions are, and we'll go from there.
The terrorist equipment seized by the police in their first raid included
disabled access ramps, marker pens, banners, radios for relaying fire and medical emergency information, the nuts and bolts holding toilet cubicles together, and blackboard paint. They have found it necessary to use pepper spray without provocation, and several campers have been arrested and bailed off the site for obstructing increasingly aggressive police officers. Everyone who enters the site is being searched. Police officers are taking anything away that could be used for illegal activity, with efforts being made to strip protesters of such hardcore weapons of choice as bits of carpet, biodegradable soap and toilet paper. In the absence of any serious threat, the police clearly found it necessary to justify their presence with an unprovoked attack on personal hygiene.
I can see clearly that police horses are blocking the front of the demonstration. It would be unreasonable to advance at the back until people have a chance to disperse at the front. Do you agree, Chief Inspector? Inspector?
We haven't got a loud hailer.
But that's all just a distraction, isn't it? Let's get into some of the real issues. Here is Ruth explaining the impact of climate on women.
All right, hello. We're with Ruth from the Global Women Strike. She's been to a few of the workshops today, and she'd like to give us some feedback from a women's perspective from the camp.
Okay. I wanted to start, actually, not with one of the workshops, but with the standoff with the police. Yesterday morning, I was really glad to hear the two sisters talking about what women can contribute, particularly to direct action. And I think one of the high points of the camp so far for me was the woman who confronted the police with this question, how many of you have children? Now, it could have been a man who said that, but it's not an accident that it was a woman, because women are the ones who, even more than men, care for our children, care about our children, invest so much of ourselves and our hopes in our children, and men, women, for that reason, I think, have always felt most strongly about climate change and have always organized on environmental issues, not only climate change, but pollution and all the other things that are actually endangering our health and our families and undoing the hard work that we do trying to keep people healthy and keep them alive. So, you know, that was, I think, a really critical question, and I did see a change in the police. And I heard that one of the police officers, I don't know if it was a man, there was one woman there, had to be taken off crying, not after that particularly, but I think we did get through to them with what they are protecting and what they're stopping us from trying to do something about. So that is a big contribution. It was not an accident that a woman made that question. On the workshops, the first one I wanted to comment on, really, was a workshop called Is It Too Late? And towards the end of that workshop, one of the people, the person leading it actually, said that the big thing that we had to count on now, that we had to hope for, was Copenhagen. And I don't think we can count on the people who are going to Copenhagen. Probably he wouldn't either. I'm, you know, don't want to sort of fix him in that box. But I think most of us in the workshop agreed that actually what happens outside and what we do is the critical thing. And for that, what we have to count is not just people like those of us who are here at the climate camp, and not only also all the other people who, for one reason or another, perhaps family responsibilities, perhaps jobs, having to earn a living, whatever, couldn't actually come to the camp. But we have to count the massive movement that exists around the world against the kind of destruction that we're seeing of the environment and of the planet. And that if we see how big that movement is, there's actually a lot more hope, because it's not just a movement in rich countries. It's not just a movement of white people. The Global Women's Strike that I work with, part of what we do is to make visible and help connect and strengthen with each other's support the movements that are not seen, which are often people who are poorest, living in the poorest countries, are often women who are generally invisible, you know, in the media. Not, you know, first of all, our suffering doesn't get seen as much. I mean, you may have heard the statistics that women are 70% of the world's poor, and therefore the most vulnerable to, you know, any loss, any, when you have hardly anything to eat and that's taken away, you're in a much different position than when you have a lot to eat and a little bit's taken away. But also 85% of people who die from climate-induced disasters. So, you know, that is how women are affected. That's some of the ways that women are affected. But what's not seen even more is the way that women are actually fighting against it. We're seen sometimes as victims, but the incredible resistance that women have organized, sometimes just organizing survival, you know, that is a form of resistance in itself, especially when they're trying to kill us all like they are now. And it is women who do the survival work in most communities. Women are not on the front line, not mostly on the front line of killing wars, but we are on the front line of the war for survival. And we are maintaining our communities and keeping our children alive in the most impossible situations. And I think if you look at Palestine, for instance, or if you look at Iraq, we have a lot to learn from what women are doing there. You know, dealing with hunger, dealing with the trauma, traumatized children, and keeping fighting at the same time. In that same workshop, one of the things that came up was James Lovelock's quote, you know, saying actually we had to give up on, because we couldn't save the world, it was too late, and we should just enjoy our lives. He has a lot of nerve, you know, when you consider what lives people have to enjoy and what fight they're still making to stay alive and keep their families and communities alive, you know, through that. And he's about to say, okay, give up, it's all right, you know, because maybe he has a comfortable life to enjoy.
That was Ruth from Live Climate Radio at the Climate Camp in the UK, August 3rd to 11th. On Saturday the 9th, there were a series of actions across the country, as we've heard. Protesters shut down the front door of the Royal Bank of Scotland, which is funding the company E.ON, the energy giant hoping to build two new coal plants at King's North. Incidentally, while the government and industry blather on about clean coal, there is absolutely no capture and storage in these British building plans. The only thing clean about it, the company has left land to build some kind of capture facility, someday, maybe. Meanwhile, and for the next 20 or 30 years, they will pump out the same dirty carbon, loading up the atmosphere to keep an energy-wasteful society on the juice. As we heard earlier, there was a simultaneous protest at the British biofuel facility and an action at Heathrow Airport to protest the expansion of holiday flying. The main group from the camp, including mothers and baby carriages, set out to reach the current King's North coal plant, its smokestacks seen pouring into the horizon. There were thousands in the march and thousands of police waiting for them. Most reached the gate and then dispersed after a banner hanging and a lot of media shots. A few stayed and were dragged away to arrest. At the same time, loads of canoes, kayaks, and homemade rafts set out to reach the power station along the river. Most were yanked out along the way by police boats, but a few straggled ashore. A small party of activists made it across the fences and into the King's North property before being arrested.
Down, rain's coming down, and everyone on camp's tired but elated, because
we didn't shut down King's North, but
we got in. Someone said to me earlier that apparently the cops spent £6 million this week, and they couldn't even actually protect the Poxy station. People still got in. People used their ingenuity. They abused us, took all our toys off us, bastards. And dogs on children, that's the cops. Sorry. Anyway, so not to get too one-sided, what we're going to do for today's show is...
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You can download hours of audio right from this year's Climate Camp at climatecamp.org.uk/radio. climatecamp.org.uk/radio. And don't forget another valuable source.
And for all of you out there listening and who can't make it to King's North, definitely go to indiemedia.org.uk for lots of coverage and other information as well. It's a wonderful resource.
Thanks to all the media activists who bring us the real action. Don't forget to record your next event, The Net is the New Radio, along with all the college and community radio stations. My real thanks to the people of Britain and Scotland who act up. These are the people who brought us civil rights and personal liberties in the first place. We need all that now and a whole lot more as we confront the greatest crisis of human history, the Great Change on polluted Earth. Find a few links in my blog, download this show and tons more free green audio from our website, all at ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. And don't we live in shocking times? I grabbed the following rap tune from Climate Radio, but nobody named the band. Can you? Write me, radio@ecoshock.org. Next week, we'll report from a conference called Peak Oil and the Media. How bad can the news get? I'm Alex Smith. Thanks so much for listening.
The age of the baby boomer generation is over. They paid their dues, and now they gotta pay for their baby food. They screwed the environment and realized it just in time for retirement. But private pensions ain't so inspiring. Some of them wonder how they're gonna get by when the government doesn't let anyone hire them. Benefits are better for teachers and firemen, but the rest ain't showing no teeth when they're smiling. Cause their kids' damn business plans is freestyling. Chilling on beaches on Tahitian Island, riding jet skis. Most MCs never gave a thought to RSPs. So the pension, tension, everybody's inching. Closer to the edge of income suspension. There's a monkey wrench in this economic engine. Listen to the dentures mention. So the pension, tension, everybody's inching. Closer to the edge of income suspension. There's a monkey wrench in this economic engine. Listen to the dentures mention. Leave us alone, leave us alone. Leave us alone, leave us alone. We ain't got no savings, are you crazy? We got gold chains with bold engravings and credit cards.
your plan? I don't really care, but somehow I'ma be a millionaire. I ain't aware of no chill in the air, cause my folks told me to feel no fear. I feel no fear. Feel the pension, tension, everybody's itching. Closer to the edge of income suspension. There's a monkey wrenching, seeking on a vengeance. Until the dentures clenching.